It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Tensions rise in the nation's schools in the aftermath of the presidential election. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Across the country, there have been reports of harassment in schools, especially against minorities, echoing the contentious presidential election. Here in Wicomico County, there are other issues facing school officials, including the potential for a post-Labor Day start of the school term and a vote for an elected school board. In our studio to take a look at these issues, we have Dr. Donna Hanlon. She is the current and new, actually, superintendent of Wicomico Public Schools, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, let me just turn to this issue that's arisen just recently, which is we've seen concern being expressed in schools about harassment. It's, as a matter of fact, I think it's in Frederick County, the public school superintendent, Terry Albin, felt that she had to issue a statement in essentially saying that she would not tolerate hurtful language targeting minorities. She issued a YouTube message encouraging students and school workers to report any inappropriate comments. What, first of all, have you seen in your school district, and what kind of measures or what kind of things are you guys doing in regards to the kind of atmosphere that just sort of has sprung up to us? One I suppose we hadn't really anticipated, certainly earlier this year.
Right. Well, I'm very familiar with the work that's going on in Montgomery County and in Frederick County, across the bridge, if you will, by those superintendents in addressing civility in their schools and the need for that. And certainly that is something that I haven't done specifically to, you know, getting that message out to students. However, we have had conversations with our school principals to make sure that they are having those conversations with students and staff, because it is important that we're addressing civility, that we're looking for opportunities for what we call teachable moments, so that students recognize the importance of respecting diversity and civility in our schools. If we have had issues, they haven't been significant issues, and they've been addressed immediately by our school administrators.
Because it seems to me that particularly people who are that young, particularly obviously elementary all the way through high school, that they're far more susceptible to these kinds of ideas, even not thinking that they are necessarily serious, but simply having fun. Right. Do you get that sense about, you know, that concern that they're a little more susceptible than maybe adults?
We are constantly, or we're very vigilant, if you will, with addressing issues that relate to bullying and harassment, even prior to what's been going on in the aftermath of the election. We take bullying and harassment very seriously. We have processes in our schools that we follow, ways that parents and students can inform us about issues that they're having if they're feeling that they're bullied or harassed. And so we do take those situations very seriously and try to address them.
So I'm going to turn now to the post-Labor Day start for schools. I'm sure you've been immersed in this. I was actually down in, I think it was Ocean City, when the governor issued his executive order along with the comptroller, Peter Franchot. So what's your feeling about this? I know that Wicomico County Public Schools has not been necessarily in favor of an early start date. That certainly separated them from Worcester County. Where are you? What are you personally? Do you think this is a good idea? Are we going to see this happen? And if it happens, how are you going to adjust to it?
Okay. Well, first of all, I believe, and I think our school board believes, that a decision about school calendar should be a local decision. And so we've been vocal about indicating that. Along with the governor's executive order came a part of the language of the executive order had to do with a waiver. A provision for a waiver for school systems that believed that they had a reason to request a start date prior to Labor Day. So the way that we address this, we brought our calendar committee together in the school system, and we created two draft calendars, a pre-Labor Day start and a post-Labor Day start. And we posted both of those calendars on our website and have been seeking public input. We've had our first round of public input, and our community spoke very clearly in favor of a post-Labor Day start. So, in fact, at our last board meeting, our board asked us, they approved the post-Labor Day start on the first reading, and we have gone back out now to the public seeking additional input on that calendar, which is a post-Labor Day start, just looking at specifics within that calendar. So we are currently in that process, and we welcome the community's input. We want to hear from community members who can go on our website and post comments in favor, opposed, with specific ideas for any tweaks to the calendar. So we're looking at a post-Labor Day start. We just haven't finalized that calendar yet. We're thinking that we're going to be doing that perhaps as early as the December board meeting.
So what is the concern then about post-Labor Day as opposed to pre-Labor Day? And what do you get more out of it? And I understand, I guess it's a hard end date, at least provisionally, of what I think is June 15th.
That's correct. What drives my decision making in terms of a calendar is instruction for students and thinking about specifics related to how are we going to be able to best meet the needs of students. In some school systems, there's been a concern with looking at dual enrollment and how we work with our community colleges, especially. In our case, our community college does start after Labor Day, so that's not an issue for us in terms of starting later than the community college. We would be in sync with a post-Labor Day start. One of the other issues, however, has to do with the hard and fast dates of advanced placement testing and the park assessments that are given in the spring of the year. Those dates are set, and starting even a week later has some educators concerned that loss of that week of instruction. We've heard the community loud and clear. They want a post-Labor Day start, so we will make adjustments within that school calendar to ensure that students' instructional needs are met.
Does a post-Labor Day start mean less days in the classroom?
No, it does not.
How do you adjust?
Within the calendar. We look at holidays, we look at length of spring break, we look at length of the winter holiday, the time between Christmas and New Year's, we look at professional days. So all of those days within that 180-day span and ending by June 15th, thinking about weather, all of those contributing factors, we have to make sure that we are aligned or that we are addressing the provisions of the contract, the negotiated contract with our teachers association. So all of those are factors that come into play when we're going to look at post-Labor Day to June 15th in making sure that we're fitting all those puzzle pieces together.
Let me ask you, there seems to be, I was seeing some of the teachers' organizations and so on, and they clearly favor a pre-Labor Day start date. Is there then this conflict between what the teachers feel and their experience, as opposed to, say, the public? Does the public not simply understand? Or, I mean, why do you get this dichotomy between these two groups, you think?
You know, I don't know that our Teachers Association favors a pre-Labor Day start. They certainly are encouraged and do post comments. So I'm going to assume that some of that 70%+ who voted for our post-Labor Day start is coming from our staff. So I don't know that there is an issue, but certainly, or a conflict there. Certainly we will work with the Teachers Association to make sure that we're considering whatever impact it would have on the teaching force.
By the way, I want to ask you, does this complicate the relationship between the public schools and Salisbury University? I had read that it does in terms of start dates because they start in a different,
I don't know that,
are you aware of that
if there is any minor conflict, I'm not aware of it. Again, it's certainly something that we will work closely with Salisbury University staff to resolve whatever issues there may be.
I want to turn also to, we have an elected, or we're going to, supposed to, at least they've voted in favor of an elected school board, right? 51%, as opposed to the other alternatives, which was a current system and a hybrid. First of all, what's your reaction to that? And do you think that's going to have any significant impact on the school system?
Well, I've worked with both an appointed board here in Wicomico and an elected board in Washington County when I was there for the 8 years that I was working in Washington County. So I've worked with both and can work with either. To me, the most important, the most significant factor in someone serving on a board of education, is that they are doing it for the right reason, that they're doing it to make decisions in the best interest of students. And I believe that that will be the case. The community has spoken loud and clear, as you've said, that they want an elected school board. And so that is how we obviously will move forward. I have said and will continue to say that individuals who are considering that run, I welcome conversations with them if they'd like to talk about what does that really mean in terms of responsibility, what does that mean in terms of timing or the time, the significant amount of time that it requires to really serve on the Board of Ed. And then as we do now with an appointed board, we provide whatever orientations that board members need in order to make sure they have the background knowledge to be able to make decisions, again, that are in the best interest of students. So I don't see that it's going to have a significant impact. It will obviously have an impact with our current board or the appointed board members going off the board in December of 18 and a brand new board. Unless current board members choose to run, it could be a brand new board as of December of 2018. So that obviously will have an impact on the school system because of that background knowledge that's going to need to be imparted. Hopefully that'll be happening along the way during the election process where candidates are seeking information, but certainly that's where I see the most significant impact, just making sure that our board members have the knowledge that they need to be able to serve in that capacity.
What do you think was the difference then between the Washington experience on the one hand, where you had an elected board, and say an appointed board? I mean, was there anything different about dealing with an elected board, or had this simply the elected board been in office for so long that whatever different initial differences or initial problems kind of now have kind of rounded out? I mean, what?
Right. I think that's probably the case. Obviously, the elected board had been in place
right. For
a time. In Washington County, they wrote at any given time during an election, it was only a few board members who were running for office. In our case, the way that the current legislation reads, all of our board members will be elected at any given time. So that's a difference. I don't really see that there is a lot of other differences, unless, you know, I just go back to my point that an elected board or an appointed board, those individuals should be there because they want to improve the community. They want to make our school system the best school system it can be, that they're making decisions in the best interest of students.
By the way, what kind of folks ran for office in Washington County? I mean, what was the spectrum? Was it business people? Was it people had political agendas, philosophical agendas? What kind of
a variety?
Right, yeah.
There were actually a few retired teachers. Gentleman who had been a retired teacher and continued to serve on the board, who I have the utmost respect for. His name is Wayne Ridenour. He's been on the Board of Education for a long time there, and you know, is probably coming at it from, you know, with teachers' best interest in mind, but also students. He was a very student-centered, friendly teacher. We had business people. We had often retired educators do gravitate towards the board. I can think of another gentleman who has since gone off the board, but had 40 some years in the classroom and serving on the board. So it is the best case scenario is when it's because they really want to do great things for students.
You mentioned a moment ago, teacher interests as opposed to student interests. Do you think there's a division? When teachers teach, you think there's a separate interest they have as opposed to their students?
You know, I guess that's possible. that's entirely possible.
You mentioned that's why I kind of asked about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's entirely possible. But again, you know, at least my perspective is that it's a balance, that we do have to be thinking about what's the work environment for teachers. That's very important. But I think you can balance that with both. I think that by having your eye on both, which I do in my role, have my eye on both working conditions and what's going to make teachers great teachers, that work environment for students, so that student instruction is where it needs to be.
But one of the things that is that occurred to me is people talked about an elected school board, and since you've had experience about it, some school boards, and we know at the state levels, there has often sometimes been a battle of political conservatives who want a particular agenda or a particular kind of education. There have been battles, obviously, over things like evolution and so on, certainly at the state level. Do you think that there is any danger of some of that politicization creeping into, say, an elected school board situation, or do you think the chances that are minimal?
I think certainly anything is possible. Anything is possible, but that's not where my focus.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't run into that. I mean, you
have not. Yeah. Have not run into that. Certainly, no matter what any individual's agenda is, I will work closely with them to make sure that they understand what's important in our public schools and why I believe. What is the background on the decisions that I make, so they have a clear understanding of that, and do the best I can to educate them on what's important for students.
So, turning to your budget, does school system have enough money? I mean, is that really the bottom line?
We are just starting our budget process. Seen lots of meetings between school administrators and our chief financial officer. So we're just starting that process, looking at what are the needs of our school. We start that process by looking at what are we currently spending our funds for and what do we need in our schools. And, you know, certainly we always need more resources, but I believe that there are lots of ways that we can think outside the box to meet students' needs that aren't necessarily tied to funds. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't, thinking about a lack of resources doesn't deter me in my work. It's, you know, I move forward with what I think is in the best interest of students. I'm new here. I haven't gone through the budget process.
Right.
So, you know, I will be working my way through it, working with the funding sources, with the county executive and the county council, and trying to educate them on what are the needs of our school system. I was very pleased that at the last board meeting, our county council president, John Cannon, came to our board meeting. And I believe, you know, I think we were all wondering, you know,
what's he doing?
John, why are you here? And he didn't speak during public comment. In fact, he just sat back and just took it in and in fact, commented to a number of us afterwards that he was really very pleased to see the current environment in the school system and the energy behind what we were doing. So I think he's very interested in educating himself on what's important for students as well.
We have obviously a Republican governor at this point, and there's a talk about some economic downturn. We've heard that from certainly the comptroller, Peter Franchot. Tax revenue is actually declining. Do you think that that we could see a decline in funding for schools? I mean, and if there were, how do you deal with that? Because the students don't go away just because there's a lack of funds or a decline in funds. I mean, how do you adjust for that?
Well, you know,
which is a question you're going to ask yourself, right?
Exactly. You know, we're going to create a budget based upon what are in the best interest, the needs of our students, what we believe instructionally is important in making sure that our schools are safe. And we're going to attempt to educate those, who are responsible for providing the funding, as I said before. And then, you know, when the end result comes about, we will adjust to make sure that our students' needs are met. Call me a Pollyanna, but I definitely believe it's doable. There is a commission on at the state level that's currently looking at funding formulas for education. That's just that the work of that group has just begun. And so all of it is to be determined.
A little uncertainty.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Finally, I want to turn to the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Career, or PARC, as they like to call it. So how do you assess, by the way, how the students are doing in your school system? What do you see in terms of improvement for the future?
Okay. Well, the PARC assessment that you refer to is the assessment, the mandated assessment that we use to assess our students in the spring of the year. When we received our assessment results back, we were very pleased. We did see increases, not only increases across the board, but increases in populations of students that we really zero in on to make sure that their needs are met, including students who are in categories like English language learners, special education, free and reduced meal students. So we did see increases. We have a long way to go, but we believe we're moving in the right direction. But I believe that the PARC assessment is just one of any number of measures. I am definitely not in favor of one test on one given day that really determines how good our school system is. There are multiple measures. And some of them are quantitative and some of them are qualitative. And so we do other quantitative assessments. For instance, we are constantly measuring students' reading levels in all of our schools to make sure students are, if they're not reading on grade level, that we are attempting to find the interventions that they need and make sure that they receive those interventions. In terms of qualitative measures, I'm getting ready to do a district-wide climate survey in Wicomico County Schools within the first 2 weeks in December. We're going to be administering that.
And what is that?
Well, we are we're asking for the community, for teachers, for students, for parents, and we're just getting those communications out. But parents and community can expect to see communication about that, and then they'll be directed towards a link where they can go online and they can provide provide feedback for us about how they believe we're doing in terms of school climate, safety, relationships in school, all of those things that have to do with the climate, the foundation to me of what's important for us to be able to do the work that we do to make sure that the climate in our schools is very positive, relationships between the home and the school, between students and parents, that I think is critically important. So I'm very excited about doing this this feedback. I'll call it a survey. Surveys sound like a one-shot deal.
Right.
That is not my intent at all. I'm very anxious to have this as a baseline, but then to dig deeper, because I have been talking a lot since I've been here, and I mean it sincerely that I believe in collaborating with the community to make our schools better.
By the way, do you think there's too much testing?
Do I think there's too much testing? I think there is the propensity to have too much testing. I know that there has been a lot of discussion about, I think that if, And I'm currently working with staff to examine this, because I want to make sure that the assessments that we use, or that we do administer, that we're using. There's no point in assessing students if we can't use it to inform instruction, if we can't use an assessment result to determine, okay, what is the next thing that this individual student needs. If we're assessing students, I'll give you a great example. We administer the kindergarten readiness assessment to all kindergartners. That assessment, it was up to individual school systems across the state. I believe the decision was made last year in individual school systems about whether to do a random sampling of kindergartners or whether to assess every student. In Wicomico County, we are assessing every kindergarten student. That takes time, but that is incredibly valuable data that we have that teachers can use to make sure that at that early age we're meeting the needs of students. So that's the kind of assessment to me that's important. If we're assessing just to assess and nothing happens with the results, that's when we have too much testing.
We've been talking with Dr. Donna Hanlon. She is the new superintendent of the Wicomico County Public Schools. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Chris Heim, inviting you to join me in the Global Village for the best in music from around the globe. Each week, we journey around the world for the most compelling new releases, rare and classic recordings, birthday spotlights, and other features and specials, along with a surprising array of artists from almost every style imaginable who incorporate international sounds into their work. That's all in the Global Village, Saturdays at 4, here on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've had to believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility, that sense of potential.
And I realize we've had to refuse to fear failure.
You got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSDL.
Donald Trump's ascendancy to the White House has drawn some sharp reaction from minorities across the country. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. With the talk of extreme vetting and banning Muslims from coming into the country from certain areas of the globe, Trump has caused a shiver to run through the American Muslim community. And there is now talk about a Muslim registry as well as advisors who see great conflict with the Islamic world. 2015, the FBI reports that hate crimes went up by over 6%, but for Muslims, it surged by 67%. Take a look at this community. We have on the phone with us Dr. Muqtada Khan. He is a professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. Also, he is the founding director of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Delaware. And welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Well, let me first of all ask you what your reaction is to Donald Trump's ascendancy, and particularly for Muslims here at home, because as I just mentioned a moment ago, there are a number of suggestions about a registry now at this point. We'll get into that a little, as well as, of course, Donald Trump's sort of broad idea of banning or barring Muslims maybe en masse or from certain countries or certain areas. What's your sense about where he is and what that might mean for your community?
Well, he's been a nightmare for about a year now, and Muslims have been quite frightened, literally, about the prospects if Donald Trump got elected, especially after he said that all Muslims should be banned. But unfortunately, this president-elect of ours sometimes or rarely speaks in full sentences, so it's very difficult to really comprehend what he was trying to say. And some of these comments that are coming out about registry of Muslims, it's not very clear what it is. But the most sense that I could make about it is to register people who are coming from Muslim countries. And we already do that. If all foreigners now who come to the United States are fingerprinted and they are photographed routinely, so I don't know what new things that he wants to do, unless it's just make a new folder on a computer somewhere. But the bigger picture is that Muslims have been scapegoated in this election to enhance the feeling among Americans that everything is not good with America. Muslims have been used as one of the scapegoats to enhance that feeling of fear that not everything is good with America, and therefore, if some punitive measures are taken against Muslims, then America will become great again. And then his proxies have been shooting their mouth off, literally. There was one of his proxies talking to Megyn Kelly on Fox News, and he was justifying this Muslim registry by using the internment of the Japanese as legal precedent. And so you can see how deep, literally how deep into the trash can his supporters are reaching. Ultimately, we will get a better picture of what his intentions are when we actually see the kind of people he appoints in key positions, especially Homeland Security and the position of Secretary of State.
Let me ask you this, because I saw a quote from the the chief executive, John Greenblatt, from the Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish group. And he said, quote, if on a day, on one day Muslims will be forced to register, that is the day that this proud Jew will register as a Muslim. What kind of pushback do you see the Trump administration getting from Americans and particularly from various minority groups?
Well, one of the things that he has inadvertently done is he has made a large number of Americans sensitive to the plight of Muslims and other minorities. So there have been a lot of sympathetic gestures by lots of people. Americans, mainstream Americans who are not Muslims are going out of the way to say nice things about Muslims, to comfort them, send positive messages. I just had one of my class make videos, documentaries for my class, in which they went out and interviewed general population from the campus and off campus. And it was overwhelming to see as to how a large number of Americans were being very sympathetic to the fact that Muslims may have a tough time now that Donald Trump has been elected. In terms of numbers right now, among those Americans who identify themselves as Democrats, 53% of them have negative views of Islam and Muslims, and 47% have positive views. That is among Democrats. But among Republicans, only 33%, that is one out of three Republicans, has positive views of Muslims. So if you look at it, the numbers by themselves are very bad, but if you look at anti-Americanism in some parts of the Muslim world, like in Jordan, for example, only 14% Jordanians have positive views of the U.S. So in that sense, we have not hit rock bottom. But there are lots of positive things coming out. One of the most positive things that came out after Trump's election was that AJC, a very prominent Jewish organization, and the Islamic Society of North America, the biggest Muslim organization, have partnered now to come up with initiatives to protect the civil rights of Muslims and Jews together to push back against any policy that promotes Islamophobia or anti-Semitism. So in that sense, it's quite possible that many good things could come out. Secondly, I also think that I agree with Hillary Clinton that maybe we should give Donald Trump a chance to start governing before we start criticizing him. Yes, he has said lots of bad things, but let's see. Maybe I hope that his governance will be markedly different from his campaigning.
Let me ask you, does this impact the way that the Islamic community views their role in society? I mean, have you seen a lot of incidents? Has there been a sense of alienation from the general society at all?
Well, fortunately, I live in a very blue state, and Delaware has been very nice and comforting during the entire political process. We were very engaged from Governor-elect John Carney to current senators and other candidates, all engaged very strongly multiple times with Muslims, made them feel at home, went out of the way to say that they do not subscribe to the views and attitude that is being propagated by Donald Trump. But having said that, there has been a spurt in crimes, hate crimes against Muslims across the board in the country, and people are really, really very frightened. But it's also mobilizing some people to be more engaged, at least commitments to be more engaged in the political process. Keith Ellison, who is one of the two Muslims runner in the Congress, is actually now running for chairman of DNC, and he's supported by Bernie Sanders and his supporters. But there are also other episodes. I have a difficult task this afternoon. I'm going to call a high school student, a Muslim high school student, who is feeling afraid to continue wearing her hijab when she goes to the school, and her parents are also worried about her because of some bullying incidents in schools. So, yes, those kind of incidents are happening, bullying not just in schools, but university campuses, and also on the streets, etc. A Muslim was firebombed in Texas this morning, I think. So, yes, the number of small incidents have certainly risen. But that's because a lot of bigoted and, shall we say, racist people are suddenly feeling emboldened because of the rhetoric of Donald Trump and his election success. So people are feeling that, oh, we are now the rulers, the views that we were afraid to espouse because they were quote-unquote politically incorrect, what they don't understand that they are also morally despicable. But now they feel more emboldened to express their intolerance and hatred towards not just Muslims but other minorities. In the last, on Wednesday, I opened my office for several hours. I have designated it as a safe place where people can come and express their grief. And the majority of the people who came to say that they're afraid and they were, you know, it's like it's people, and a lot of them were white students and some were Hispanic and minority students. But the response this time that I have seen is as if there's been a death of a beloved in the family. That's how a lot of people are responding to the current election. I have never seen this. I've observed many elections in many countries, but this is the first time I'm seeing that people are grief-stricken by the outcome of this election. And that is perplexing as well as also, you know, heart-wrenching.
In the few minutes we have left here, I want to turn to foreign affairs. What kind of sense do you get about the Trump approach to international affairs? There's been a idea floated that John Bolton, for instance, could wind up being Secretary of State. He's apparently recently has talked about regime change in Iran. How do you see a Trump foreign policy changing the way the U.S. relates to that area, and what impact that then will obviously have on the area itself?
Well, it's very important the person that he selects for Secretary of State. The names that are being thrown around there are obviously Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton. Giuliani is apparently in the lead for this position, but also Mitt Romney and Nikki Haley are also being considered. So if either Nikki Haley or Mitt Romney become Secretary of State, then I think the message that Donald Trump will send to the international community is relax. I'm not that crazy. I'm not going to do very stupid things. But if he nominates John Bolton as Secretary of State, then the message that he's probably going to send the rest of the world is, yes, I am just as crazy as you thought I am. And I think that will have a very difficult impact. For example, if the United States were to have people like John Bolton and the old Bush one neocons back into power, then I think there will be a massive pushback from the international community. Sarkozy has already announced that if the United States withdraws from the Paris Climate Agreement, then there should be a tax imposed, a carbon tax on the U.S. and so on. So the rest of the world is, I think, not ready to play ball with this president if he were to do things that could undermine. My biggest worry is that some of his measures, which he is recommending on the international front, may be financially beneficial for the United States on the short term. His selective isolationism may benefit the U.S. financially in the short term, but will undermine the global economic and security order in the long term. So that is my biggest worry, such as cutting funding for NATO, deciding not to do anything about Syria. Yes, this will reduce the cost of war and other spending, but it will undermine global security. And that is my biggest worry, that in order to show some results, this administration might take short-term steps, you know, penny-wise, pound-foolish kind of strategies. It is very important that somebody explain to Donald Trump as to how critical and vital the United States is for global security and global stability.
And
I hope he understands that before he makes any drastic changes.
We've got to wrap up there. We've been talking to Dr. Muqtada Khan. He is a professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. Also, he is the founding director of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Delaware. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much, Don. Bye.
Perhaps the community most impacted by the election of Donald Trump to the presidency is the Hispanic community, and in particular, the undocumented. President Obama allowed young undocumented immigrants to temporarily stay in this country under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. During the campaign, Trump promised to end the program, deporting all undocumented immigrants. Since his election, Trump has emphasized that he would first deport those undocumented immigrants who have committed crimes. 19-year-old Miguel Tapia Collin is a student at Columbia University and came to this country as an infant. His interest is in political science. He recalls when he first heard the news that Trump had been elected president.
It kind of started looking really bad, and it was just like, it just got really emotional at the end because it was like, we knew that it wasn't going to be good. So the next day, you know, we woke up, and I know that for me, it was like, I woke up crying because it was just like, I could not believe it. And then when I had to go to work, I can tell you, Don, that the two-block commute to work was the most, one of the most intense things that I experienced, because there was just an eerie silence in New York. Like, nobody was looking up. Nobody was talking. It was, you know, as busy as a regular day in New York City, but you didn't even hear the cars honking. Cars weren't even making noise. People were just breaking down on the streets. I had friends who were commuting to work that had to use the subway. And even then, like, the subway was so eerie. A lot of people, I mean, I wasn't here the day after 9/11. I was back in Delaware, very young. But a lot of the older folks that I'm friends with, they were saying that the silence and eeriness and just the sadness that was felt in the city in public spaces like the subway was so similar to that day after 9/11. And it's hard to compare that, obviously, because the two events are very different from each other. But you can really say that the, you know, sadness and just the disappointment that was felt was so similar. Like, it was crazy. I'd never had experienced anything like that.
What did your friends say to you as they realized that this was happening?
I mean, in that moment, it was in the moment, nobody said anything to me, and I don't think I said anything to anybody either, because it was more of like, you know, we were thinking to ourselves like, oh my God, our lives are going to change, and it's going to be not for the good, it's going to be for the bad, because, you know, I was, like I said, I was there with friends, and we were all diverse. You know, I was there with gay friends, I was there with Black friends, I was there with Muslim friends. You know, we all were together, but we were all, you know, experiencing it in our own way and in our own, like, almost selfish manner. I want to say that we really didn't have words for each other. We were just kind of like, holy cow, you know, my life is about to, you know, change.
How about your parents? How did they react?
I didn't reach out to them that night, but I can tell you that, like, in my thought process, I was coming home. As I was coming home, I was crying too, because it was like, wow, you know, like, they're going to wake up to, you know, this news. And, you know, my dad's going to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to work. And, you know, my mom is going to wake up, you know, at 6:30 to go clean a house. And, you know, and it may be, you know, a Trump supporter's house. And, you know, they're going to wake up to these news, and it's just going to be the most heartbreaking thing. And, in fact, you know, my mom texted me, and she put in, like, the Apple emojis in the text, and they were very upsetting. I was just like, it was, like, heartbreaking just to read those texts. It was like, did he really win? Like, oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Is there a sense that the great adventure that certainly they've embarked upon in getting you into school, going to Columbia, all that could end?
There is a sense. I can tell you that the 2 days after the election, they were very depressing for, I think, at least for me, it was very depressing. Like, I just could not, like, I could not function well because it was scary, you know. It was just like, I really couldn't. But I can tell you that in the days following those days, we've become hopeful, and we've become, you know, I'm hopeful that nothing's going to happen. We can't, obviously that's not promised, but we are hopeful. I know there's right now a movement around Columbia to a lot of students. It started out off as a faculty petition, and now it's a university-wide petition to the administration, so they could promise to remain a sanctuary for undocumented students, as well as uphold the promise of financial aid in case DACA is removed, which means that, you know, we wouldn't be able to work and financially support us as well as we could.
Do you sense any optimism about the idea that the president-elect has said that he's going to deport folks with criminal backgrounds, and then he's going to look at the rest? Did you take any solace in any softening of the rhetoric?
I think it's funny because, you know, everything he ran on is suddenly, like, flip-flopping. It's like everything he ran on just suddenly changed. Like you said, like now he's saying that, you know, we're going to take a look at the criminals and, you know, we're going to let the good people stay. And, you know, there's other issues that he's kind of been like flip-flopping on, which is interesting. But I think the interesting thing that we have to take a look at, and as Americans and as people who, you know, are really concerned at this moment, is that he's really putting racists in his cabinet. He's putting people who, in my opinion, are very dangerous to be holding those positions.
Are you referring to Steve Bannon?
Yes.
In terms of the Hispanic vote, there certainly was a surge in the cities. And yet, according to one poll I saw, Trump actually got about 29%, a couple of points above what Romney got. Are you surprised at that? Do you think those figures are real?
I mean, I can't tell you if they're real or not. I'm certainly surprised. I'm extremely surprised. I was extremely surprised that that percentage was not, the 11% that was projected. And I'm even more surprised that, you know, as many women voted for him. So, I mean, everything, like the whole election, the whole outcome of the election, just a shocker. Like, you look at the numbers.
Do you know any Hispanics who voted for Trump?
I personally don't. I'm kind of in my own bubble where, you know, I grew up in, northern Delaware, where a lot of the Democratic population lives. And, you know, I work with, obviously, undocumented immigrants who are ineligible to vote. And here in New York, everybody seems to be a liberal, and I mean, a lot of New York actually supported Bernie Sanders.
So there's about 700,000 or 800,000 folks like yourself who are in the country, at least temporarily. What do you think is going to happen to them, and how big of an impact do you think that's going to have in terms of the Hispanic community, particularly the undocumented community?
I mean, I really don't know what to tell you. I honestly do not know what to tell you, because right now, there's a lot of questions that I personally have. There's a lot of questions that I know the community has, and it's very unclear what they're going to look like, what the answer to that's going to be. I think we're certainly afraid, right now, I try not to think about it. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we just have to hope for the best. We have to hope for the best that, you know, we're not going to be kicked out, or, you know, there's going to be something that's going to prevent, you know, whatever legislation or whatever program if they want to enact from happening.
Because the last time, as a matter of fact, we talked, you were sort of optimistic about the idea that you might be able to stay. Have you lost some of that optimism?
I think I still have it. You know, while I'm scared, I still have that optimism because, you know, the kind of the weapon that I have in my back pocket is my education. You know, that's what I have in my back pocket. You know, the fact that I can turn around and, you know, say, look, you know, I'm a student and I'm working hard for this and I'm here. I'm not any of the criteria that essentially you need to get out of the country.
By the way, have you seen any kind of backlash, or particularly that folks face, for instance, who are American citizens but happen to be Hispanic? You've heard anything about that at all in terms of supporters, say, of Trump, that kind of thing?
I'm friends with Trump supporters, and a lot of people I noticed on Facebook were deleting Trump supporters, blocking them, and I felt that to be very disrespectful. Because at the end of the day, I respect everybody's political views, but it's very hard after the election to try to understand them, try to kind of comprehend them. While I respect them, it's very hard to have a Trump supporter message you and tell you, oh, he didn't mean that, oh, this is not real, because he may have not meant that, but look at the people he's working with. Rhetoric that, you know, he created around, you know, the undocumented population.
Any final thoughts about the election and you going forward?
It's very upsetting. It's very upsetting. We can only hope for the best. Right now, I feel very lucky to be in a sanctuary city like New York that has protected immigrants for generations. My parents are still concerned about me even stepping out to the supermarket, because there has been a little bit of backlash towards some people of color and some communities here in New York. But I think I'm more worried about them in a state like Delaware.
19-year-old Miguel Tapia Cullen, a student at Columbia University who came to this country from Mexico as an infant. has been able to temporarily stay under President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. We now turn to the African-American community, which gave Hillary Clinton an 8-point advantage in the presidential election over Donald Trump. It was also Donald Trump who gained prominence from the birther movement that questioned Obama's citizenship. In Delaware, Reverend Donald Morton is with the Tabernacle Full Gospel Baptist Cathedral in Wilmington. He, like a number of pastors in the first state, tried to console his flock. We caught up with the Reverend Morton, who has been involved with the group Complexities of Color, aimed at attacking discrimination in the first state. What was your initial reaction when you got word that Donald Trump had become president-elect?
Well, I was in a man cave, my personal man cave, watching television, watching the returns, and how the Electoral College was shaping up. And I was in shock, literally, because that which I thought could never happen, particularly given all of the things that were said and done throughout this process, this campaigning process, would not allow for a Donald Trump presidency. And so I have to admit that I sat a pretty long time with my mouth open, wondering whether or not this was real. And at the end of the day, I found out that it was, to my surprise. But then I think that we just kind of saw this shaping up to be through a series of events that took place over the course of the campaign that made it possible for a Donald Trump presidency to actually take place.
What do you think those elements were?
Well, I think there were a couple of things. I think that our inability to focus on issues, I think it was very clear who was more qualified, not just as it relates to temperament, but political prowess, who was more qualified to be president. I think we started paying attention to things that were distracting from the real issues. And I think we also had an opportunity, unfortunately, to unveil just how far America has not come with regard to its bigotry, its racism, its sexism, its misogyny, that we were not prepared yet to have a president who was a woman. I think that is also something that we need to converse about at some point.
You were quoted as saying that you were fearful of what Trump's election might mean to the black community and for America. What did you mean by that?
There were a lot of things that Donald Trump said during the course of the campaign that were just really nasty, vitriolic kinds of comments that I did not expect him to be able to recover. The African-American community, one comment in particular, which everyone glanced over and just kind of clowned about, was him saying, "Look at my African-American over there," right? The African-American community we've been called a boatload of names through how he has referred to our current president. I'll never forget the fact that Donald Trump has made it clear that he doesn't even trust the legitimacy of President Barack Obama. Those things don't get lost on us. So we still remember many of the things that he has said. And our prayer at this point is that his comments, his ideas, his ideologies, his values, his ethics don't translate into policies that that affect African-American people that are black and brown across our nation. I'm scared that what he has said is actually what he will do. And if what he does is a mirrored reflection of what he has said, our nation's in trouble.
What was the reaction of your congregation, and how did you try to, I assume, console them?
Well, I attempted to tell our congregation that we've been here before, that this isn't that God is always, my theology teaches me that God is always on the side of the oppressed. He's never on the side of the oppressor. And at the end of the day, we have a responsibility to be productive. We have a responsibility to pray. We have a responsibility to be patient with God's plan. And America, by and large, has been oppressive. Its government, its systems, its policies have been oppressive to black and brown folk since our arrival here in America. And I think the difference between a Donald Trump presidency and the presidency of a Reagan, a Bush, or others is the fact that those policies were far more subtle. Nobody talked about those policies. They were under disguise. What Donald Trump has done is to not just say, I'm going to introduce policies, but he's talked very boldly about those policies, and he doesn't have a filter. So we get a chance to prepare for a Donald Trump presidency, much in a way that is antithetical to what we've been unable to do with other presidents prior to Trump.
What sense, by the way, do you get about your congregation? Were they in shock? Did they, by the time they saw you, were they getting over shock?
No, they're not. They are not past shock. They still are in shock. Many of them are still crying. Many of them are still in disbelief. And I think the surprise for them is not just a Donald Trump presidency. The surprise for them is the fact that anyone would cast a ballot for Donald Trump, even many Republicans. And I have great respect for many Republicans. We disagree on a number of different issues, a wide range of issues. But there are people that are far more qualified than Donald Trump to be president on the Republican side. And I guess what I lost respect for, even with many Republicans, is how many of them laid down their values and ethics to side with a Donald Trump simply to make sure that the Republican Party was in power.
Finally, are you concerned about the potential for incidents against the African-American community or, for that matter, other communities? I know there was a church burning in Mississippi connected to at least some graffiti with Donald Trump. I saw actually a photograph of some graffiti which said, quote, Black lives doesn't matter and neither does your vote, end quote. And the FBI, of course, has talked about an increase in racially motivated incidents. Are you concerned about an atmosphere that might result from this election?
Well, I'm yes and no. So on the one hand, I'm concerned about any hate speech, right? This is not anything new. We've endured hate speech. We've been called the N-word. We've been called monkeys. The president has been called a monkey. The first lady has been called a monkey. This is where our nation is. My greater concern is not graffiti. My greater concern is not a church burning. My greater concern is how do those values and that immorality translate into policies with you taking that language and codifying that language into something that is going to impact and affect my life, my children's lives, my grandchildren's lives. I'm concerned right now about Donald Trump's choices for his cabinet members, those that will influence him, those that have his ear, do not at all reflect America. In fact, there are parades being planned right now by the KKK who are absolutely excited about a Donald Trump presidency. That has to say something. And Donald Trump has come out and he said to all of his followers, let's stop. Let's stop all of the language. But you can't come out later on and say, let's stop the language, when your entire campaign created the environment out of which the language emerges. So I'm concerned with what the policies are going to be, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I'm concerned about what the Supreme Court appointment's going to look like that will impact well beyond my lifetime. It's those things. Being called the N-word is one thing that I can overcome. Being treated like the N-word by codifying a language and ideology is something that I'm not so sure I, my children, or grandchildren will be able to overcome.
Reverend Donald Borden is with the Tabernacle Full Gospel Baptist Cathedral in Wilmington.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.